Hey guys, Mike here. Hey, welcome to this episode of Mountain and Marsh. On this episode, Sean Butler calls in. We're going to talk about some morel mushrooms. I know a lot of people have asked me about my morel mushroom hunting, my foraging. I'm going to be honest, guys. I just shoot from the hip. I know a little bit about it. But everybody had questions and more in-depth questions than I was able to answer. And so I had Sean on because he and his wife and his daughter are professional morel hunters. These guys are legit. And they also own Longspur Tracking and Outfitting. You might have seen them on social media. They got trackers, dog and drone trackers all over the place, from deer to bears. These guys do all kind of work. Sean is a forester, a private wildlife manager, an outdoor writer. The guy is, he lives, eats, sleeps, breathes the outdoors. He's from Buchanan, West Virginia. He knows the mountain. If you guys want to learn about morels, this is a great podcast, and learn a little bit about some other foraging as well. Some little tips, tricks, tactics, some knowledge that you can take into the woods with you. Thank you guys for listening, as always. Guys, I want to let you guys in on a little secret on Maryland's Eastern Shore. Webb Johnson, Quaker Neck Outfitters, and Gun Club. These guys are top-notch when it comes to killing whitetails, doves, and waterfowl of any species. These guys tear up birds in flooded impoundments on creeks, ponds, rivers, you know, the bay. These guys are doing it all, and they're doing it really well. They aren't a guide who baits a hole with corn. They just flood a cornfield and hunt it. You can go down there right here in Maryland, and you can have a flooded cornfield hunt. How cool is that? There's been a lot of pintails around. How about a black duck? How about a teal? Anything you want, really, guys. Hey, the sky's the limit over there. Pit blinds, A-frames. Check them out. QuakerNeckGunClub.com. Hey, guys. What's up? Hey, Dependable Dog Services LLC is a duo of dog trainers who have spent years in the trade, and now they are their own company. They are helping people have better relationships with their dogs now. If your dog is an issue, it's a bit of a problem child. No matter what the issue, these folks can help you with it. You get a puppy, you want to make sure it's trained up right. These folks can help you with it. Dependable Dog Services. DependableDogServices.com. Give them a call at 240-707-0422. Thanks, guys. Hey, everybody, Mike here. Welcome back to the podcast. Today I have Sean Butler on. Sean, can you tell people who you are, where you're from, your background, and why you're here to talk about some morels?
Okay. Well, Mike, I really appreciate it. This is great. I love appearing on these podcasts and talking about some of our passions. And we're from over here in Buchanan in West Virginia, right in the center part of the state. Got some roots in Maryland. Glad to hook up with you. I am a mountain boy, born and raised, Air Force veteran. Went to a small college called Glenville State College here in West Virginia and got a forestry degree along with a business management degree. And I also hold a master's degree in biology from a small university out in Idaho called Alameda University. My background is I've lived in the woods my whole life, hunting, fishing, foraging, and, of course, forestry and logging. It's a passion of mine. And along with that came the want and the urge to hunt morels, and to make the most of it. I used to be just one of those guys that sit down during spring turkey season and say, oh, there's four or five right here around me. And I, you know, as I got older into my 20s, I was like, I want to get good at this. I want to find these things. So I become a student of the morel and a student of forestry. And that's how I got my start.
You said something that's really interesting. You stated that you're a forester, and I feel that an important part of understanding all foraging, but especially morels, is being a woodsman or woods lady, not being someone who only knows one way. You really have to be able to kind of read what's around you while foraging for all things. And that probably really helps you out.
Well, I tell people, you know, in anything we do in the outdoors, always be a woodsman first. We own a wounded game tracking company, and that's what I tell all my guys that work for me. I don't care how good your dog is, you got to be a woodsman. So that same thing applies, as you said, to foraging, to morel hunting. And then a lot of the people we take out morel hunting, one of the things I tell them about that is to learn those trees, and you got to look up before you ever look down. And that's to know those trees. And that is such a big part of morel hunting.
Yeah, that's when I first started myself. Actually, what had happened was I stumbled upon some, and I've hunted turkeys for my entire life, and I've hunted turkeys in the mountains of Virginia. And some of the folks down around Staunton, Virginia, where we hunt, they would rather go look for morels than chase turkeys. And to me, before I understood morel hunting and the difficulty behind it, I didn't get it at all. I thought, man, like there's nothing more fun to me. And to this day, it's my favorite thing to hunt. There's nothing more fun to me than chasing mountain birds. But for some of these people, like it was so addictive. And now that I know how fun it is and how rewarding it can be, now I spend a lot of time, like I'm standing on a ridge top and I'm looking at the next ridge over, like, is that an elm tree? I don't know. I don't, but that's just, I spend a lot of time doing that now. It's time that I never did that before, you know?
Right. Right. Yeah, it's a passion. It's something that just gets a hold of you. There's very few things to compare it to out there. When we get morel hunting, well, we'll just, hey, let's check this path. And then let's go over and check this tree. Before you know it, you've been out there all day. And it doesn't seem like it. You're like, dang, we got to get back. But it is definitely a passion. I compare it to anybody that's ever maybe even searched for Doug Ginseng. That it's the same kind of passion to go with that. So it's we love it. And I sent you pictures yesterday. I mean, we had dinner at the house and it's like, well, let's kill some time. Let's go mushroom hunting. So we hit a patch within a few hundred yards of the house and came out with a half a sack full. It was pretty good. But yeah, we love it. And we try to educate as many people as we can about it.
It seems like one of those things where depending on where you live, it can be more prevalent. And because like here in central, I'm in South Central Pennsylvania. But I grew up in Central Maryland, and these areas here, there's a lot of people who don't even know what a Morel is. And
right.
But I grew up spending a lot of time in the mountain, and I know what they are, and I know the power that they held over people. And for a long time, I didn't do it myself. I just knew how devoted some people were to it. And people will see, like at a Wegmans, they'll see dried morels in a bag for, I don't know, how much do they sell for a pound now? Like, you know, $80 or I don't know, but it's a lot.
Yeah,
I'll see that and think to myself, like, well, I guess that's where the drive comes from, because, you know, they are expensive. Not many people know how to cultivate them. And that's the big catch. That's what drives people. You know, there's a sense of pride for some people when it's like, hey, that guy can, you know, somebody like you, somebody who every year in and year out, knows where to go, has spots, and finds large chunks of morels. There's a lot of people like me who enjoy doing it and find maybe 50 a year. So, you know, just because I'm not, the areas nearby to me are not easy on morels. A lot of red clay, a lot of sycamore groves. These aren't your big boomer tulip poplar areas, but you know, I still enjoy doing it very much.
Well, and you kind of mentioned the area. You're saying there in your area that the sycamore on the red clay isn't very good for you, where in our area, the sycamore on the red clay can be the hot spot, especially if that red clay's been disturbed, say, by gas well drilling or a landslip from an old road or something. And we get sycamore that grows back up on those slips, and it's red clay right there on the soil, and that's where we'll find just flushes of wild, good wild morel.
Oh yeah, I do find from time, I do have one spot that gets a good bit of sunlight, and it does, it produces big ones. Actually, that's where I found like the biggest, like over a foot. One of them was like, I found the biggest ones I've ever found there on this one slope next to a river. Gets a lot of sunlight, and it is a good spot. But I don't know why the areas, I'll put it this way. I got some sycamores right here behind my house, and this is some rocky soil here. They hardly produce. I do find maybe 10 here a year, and that's it. But I don't find much. But
right. Sycamores are one of our favorite trees, but we don't find many morels around river bottom or creek bottom sycamores. Of course, over here, we're kind of mountainous. So about mid-slope, when we find a band of sycamores, that's where we'll end up finding morels. So you'll have sycamores growing around maybe springs, places like that. On the mid slope, and boy, they can be loaded, especially in another week and a half here in our area. It's going to be pretty good. I know you were talking about poplar. Poplar is something, yellow poplar, that we have a lot of, and we tend to find a lot of early black morels around poplar in our area, especially poplar that's really got some old growth grapevines growing up in it. I mean, it has that really good, rich black soil. You just get that feeling when you're walking in it that there should be some fungus here, especially morels. Man, I do know my tree species, but I tell people it's almost a feeling. It's almost like a farmer walking out on plowed soil and saying, boy, I can grow some corn here. You get that feeling with morels once you hunt them a while. Boy, there should be some morels here. And then if you start hunting around, you'll find it.
I feel like you can sometimes with hardwood trees like poplars and elms, you can almost smell it. Like it smells, especially like a day after a rain. It almost feels like when you walk up to like a dying poplar tree in the mountain and the soil's really rich, it almost smells like there's mushrooms there. It smells fungusy, if that makes any sense.
It makes perfect sense. And I tell people, you can smell it. You get that feeling. You can feel it in your feet, the sponginess of the soil. And once you start getting those feelings down and learn those trees, and of course, sharpen your eye, because some of these species of morels that we can get into here in a couple of minutes or can be smaller, but they're there. And you can find a lot of them. So, go by all your senses. Look up before you ever look down, and trust your woodsmanship.
Before we jump into the species of morels, would it be okay if we kind of go through the types of areas and trees that correlate? Because I know that's a question that I get a bunch.
Sure.
So what would you say the top ones are?
Well, I'm going to tell any beginning morel hunter in any part of the East here to learn what woods grown apple trees are going to look like and what elm trees look like. And you need to learn those too. Is that where you're going to find a lot of morels? Probably not. But are you going to consistently find morels? Yes. If you can find an apple tree or an old apple orchard from an old homestead in the woods, at some point in time in the spring, you're probably going to find morels around it. The field edge apple trees, we've had pretty good luck with, but it seems like if they're shade, those apple trees are shaded, they're in decline. They're putting out that signal with that, that morel to pop, and they do. So apple tree number one, number two, elm. Elm, it's hard to describe. You know, when it has a leaf, it has a serrated, non-compound leaf. But I can look at them and tell this time of year they have some, especially red elm, has those red flower, what we call flower clusters on them. But that bark is spongy. If you walk up, push on that bark, and it's spongy, it's probably an elm. Get you a good tree book and learn what elms are. Once you do that, then start looking for elms that are going into decline. Not a dead elm, but one that's declining. Maybe it's got a live branch or two on it, but maybe what I like to find is when those ones that are sloughing that bark off, that are starting to die, that bark's falling off at the top, it's laying around the bottom of the tree, you will find morels around that elm tree at some point during the spring. It doesn't mean you're going to find them the day you go check them, but they're going to be there. So you need to, we kind of like go every 2 or 3 days when we find those elm trees, just to check and make sure all throughout the spring, because we know we're going to catch a flush some point in time around that tree. So those are the two important trees, that every beginner should learn. And then of course, poplar, yellow poplar is a cove, what we call a cove hardwood. Grows great on north and northeast facing slopes up here in the mountains. And that's where your better soil is. I like to find older growth poplar, trees, maybe that were like growing in an old field at one time, and then a poplar forest came in. So you're seeing all these poplar trees that are 18, 20 inches through. And then all of a sudden there's the granddad of all the poplar trees. Looks like you could probably park a pickup truck on the stump if you cut it.
Yeah.
That's where I'll start centering my mushroom hunting at, is around that tree, and go out from there. And if you can find that, you know, those big old granddad trees and those poplar patches, and start just going out in circles from there, you'll start finding a lot of mushrooms, especially, poplar morels and the black morels. So, then we were touching on sycamore. Sycamore trees are important. Like I said, mid-slope trees. In some areas, sycamore and creek bottoms and river bottoms do produce. In our area, not so much, but maybe in Ohio, and I'd say Maryland, your climate, once you start getting down from the mountains coming down towards Hagerstown and east, you probably should have some creek bottom morels around some sycamore trees. So probably a good place to look. Other than that, as indicator trees go, I mean, those are your four real big ones, real important ones. We do find morels and hickory patches on north and east facing slopes up near the ridge, but that's not like a yearly occurrence. It's like when the weather's perfect, you'll get flushes in the hickories like that. We see that about every 4 or 5 years.
That's funny, because I have hickories all around my house, and all around Gettysburg there's a lot of shag bark, and I've always thought that this place sucks, because I really wish I had more like poplar trees and sycamore trees and I guess I'll have to take a look. I mean, it looks like we're gonna get a good start this year. It's gonna be pretty fruitful, so maybe I'll take a look.
Yeah, take a look around those trees. We probably found 30 or 40 round hickories yesterday. In fact, you know, they grow so well around hickories in the South that if you go to Kentucky and ask about a morel, they just kind of look at you, because they call them hickory chickens down there. So that kind of tells you they grow in hickory patches. But like I said, it's not a consistent thing. We find them about every 4 or 5 years in good clutches throughout the hickory. So, but it's always worth checking. We eat up a lot of boots walking around checking all these patches. So,
do you find that are you ever finding any around oaks at all? Because I had heard from old heads a long time ago that oaks produce morels. I don't think that's a thing, because I've looked around a lot, because I've been around them a lot, hunting turkeys on oak flats and things, and I've never found any morels. Is that something that maybe happens?
It's not one of my first places I'm going to look is an oak patch, but when I'm turkey hunting, my eyes are scanning, and I have found them on oak flats, but it's been exceptional weather for morels. You know, they're just good flushes. That mycelium, I think, just exists everywhere in the soil. Because, I mean, a morel is going to pop wherever a morel wants to pop. Okay, I found them in yards. We found them on gravel roads. I mean, it's just amazing where they are at. But, we can help you narrow down to try to find a good amount. And then once you do that, you can become a morel hunter with a good eye, and you start spotting them in places that they shouldn't be. But yeah, oak isn't a preferred forest type to look in, but just because it isn't preferred doesn't mean they aren't there.
I had heard also from some locals down in outside of Staunton, Virginia, where we hunt at down there. I had heard that black morels like to grow in this pine patch that the locals knew of, that was like down off the mountain and that's something I didn't know that happened either. I guess it's just the mycelium's everywhere. I don't know exactly how mycelium works, but I know that it's everywhere. If you go into the woods and you dig up some soil, you see a bunch of different things in the soil, and a lot of, you know, there's mycelium in there, and there's all different types of things that live in topsoil is dense, and it's almost like a mat in some areas, just how dense everything is, the fibrous and then the mycelium. And so I think that like everything has the chance to grow everywhere if the conditions are correct.
Right. And that's what it is conditions. Of course, the better the conditions, the more of a flush you're going to find over a wide range of area. The worse the conditions for mushrooms, then that's what separates the good mushroom hunters from the hobby mushroom hunters, that can find them in good condition. But you were talking about pine pad. We have good luck finding the nice big yellow morels around white pine at times. And then black morels do love pine, and they grow out west in the pines. And after a forest fire, I mean, they'll find just tons of black morels coming up in burn areas where the pines have grown and have been burned off. And then that soil is disturbed, that mycelium is disturbed, and they just put up tons of mushrooms. So, yeah, I mean, pine, I find them in white pine, sometimes under a Virginia pine or pitch pine. Very seldom do I find them under spruce. Maybe just a couple times in my lifetime have I found a morel under spruce.
So with morel, you had talked about, we've talked kind of a little bit about the different morels. This is one thing that I don't quite understand is, I understand the tree to mushroom correlation. I know which trees do the best, even when times are tough, conditions are tough for morels. I know which trees are going to give me the best opportunity. I actually live on the fruit belt here in Gettysburg. So there's a bunch of old orchards around, and that's a big deal around here. But when it comes to different types of morels, I know that there's yellow. That's what I normally find in my sycamore patches here and around any hardwoods I've found. I guess that's just part of the mycelium system where I'm hunting them. And I know there's black ones. But what is, like, I find these gray ones. Like, they're like a grayish black, and maybe that's still considered a black, but I'm going to tell you, I don't think it looks like a black. And I find those in one of my sycamore patches. I don't understand. What's up with that?
Well, here's the deal. I mean, there's so many species, but we kind of try to keep it simple for people. The black morels, which have that perfect Christmas tree shape that you find, and they are dark. They're actually my favorite one to find. I love finding the black patches, because when you find one one of those black ones, you're probably going to find 50 right there close by. And they're the early morel. That's the morel that brings in spring. I'll find black ones in good, warm, disturbed soil at 3,000 feet here in West Virginia in March. Okay, and that's just amazing. And they seem to be the hardiest ones. We find them heavily associated with poplar trees. If we're in that old growth poplar, we're going to find some black morel. Then the next, as the season progresses, here what we're finding now in the sycamore patches, we're finding what we call gray morel. They're a mid-sized morel, probably what you were finding, like you were talking about.
Yeah.
They don't get as big as those yellow ones do, the big, beautiful yellow ones.
Yeah.
But they'll get mid-sized there. And those are where we get a lot of our numbers from, because we find a lot of gray ones. We found 335 in one patch on Saturday, and that patch was no bigger than the size of a school bus. And they were growing. They were growing on a gas line that was running through the woods. There, and one of the trees I forgot to mention that we used to find a lot of morels around is ash. And unfortunately, you know, the emerald ash borers went through and wiped out the ash trees. So there's a few dead ash along this gas line, and that's the only associative species that I can see there. And man, the last 2 years, this little patch has just absolutely bloomed with a huge flush. And so, you know, 335 morels, which we just posted that on our Facebook, that hunt as a YouTube show this evening. So if somebody wants to go watch that and see what those little gray morels look like, that's a good example. Then here now we're we're just now starting to get into our yellow morel season, and that's where you'll find big mushrooms. Okay, that these are the ones that'll grow around your apple trees. You might only find six or seven, but they'll be good size. Most of the time, when you find them, they're fist size, and they're the ones everybody seems like everybody can find. And then when we have this really good wet weather, like we're having this spring, we find what we call poplar morel. If you look them up in a book, I think that's how they're listed most mushroom books, is poplar morel. They're small. They're about thumb size. But man, when you find one of those, you usually find 75 or 80 right there in a small area. And they are flavorful. A lot of chefs like those. We love those for putting them on pizzas and stuff like that, just because of the flavor and the size. And then the last morel, a lot of people find, are the half free or the half cap morels. We call them snakeheads over here. They're mostly stem, a little bit of cap, but they are a morel and they are very flavorful. And, when I had a good friend that was a chef at a big lodge over here, I used to get the best money out of those half cap or half free morels just because of their flavor, not because of what they look like. But they usually put those in cream of mushroom soup and these bisques and stuff like that to get that strong morel flavor. But those are the main species we hunt over here, and I'm sure it's probably pretty much the same over your way.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. I would say that's one that I, so because we talked earlier about the sycamores, and the red clay, I had the idea in my head for years that the reason that I was finding small flushes on these sycamore patches that were on private land were because the red clay was so tight. And the red clay around us, where I can privately hunt these, are it's not disturbed ever. It's left to its own. These are woods that I've hunted for some years, and so these areas are left undisturbed. Now, talk about big yellows. I have found. Unfortunately, the biggest one I ever found was completely dried up. Was in one of those patches of morels and was in red clay dirt, and it was huge. Like it was like a foot long. Like it was a big morel. And I think I still got a picture somewhere of it. Like from fingertip down past my wrist onto my forearm, and just a heck of a. But it was dead. And so I have seen large mushrooms in those areas, but I just never see that many. And I wonder if that has to do with maybe the soil never being disturbed, or if that maybe has to do with lack of nutrients. And I don't know the histories of these stretches of land. You know, the topsoil that's over top this red clay, it's not very deep. So maybe at one point it was stripped. And then it, you know, reestablished itself. I know the topsoil has a pretty good deal to do with the abundance and the growth of morels, because they do like to soak up nutrients.
Right. I mean, when you find nutrient rich environments, you'll find morels. That's for sure. One of the things we see, though, is heavy flushes on what we call disturbed soil. We have a lot of hillside gas wells, old shallow gas wells in West Virginia. And what they used to do is just build a road up to a flat on a hill and basically dig out a little half-acre flat spot to put a drill rig and drill. And you know, to build that flat spot, they had soil piles that went over the edge, just which was soil. And that soil would start growing sycamore. And when that sycamore gets to 10, 15 years old, below every one of these gas wells, you will find if the conditions are right and you're there at the right time, you will find hundreds of yellow morels. We have two or three areas like this that we don't even count the mushrooms. We just weigh them and go by pound. One gas well or slip site below a road, we found 15 pounds two or three years back of morels. That's just probably a couple thousand morels in a small area. So, yeah, good soil is a great place to look. I think at times disturbed soil is even a better place to look. And I think that's why they flush after forest fires and that topsoil layer is burnt and disturbed, they flush. So, I mean, yeah, we have our patches where everything, conditions are perfect, soil's perfect, and we're going to find morels. But our biggest flushes come from disturbed soil.
I've been told that before to chase fire. And this was actually in an area close to me, there's a chunk of woods. They got the fire out pretty quick, but there was a chunk of woods that caught fire. Some kids accidentally caught it on fire. And it's a spot that I turkey hunt. And while I was in there scouting for birds, the other morning, I passed this on the way in, and I'm in the dark. I'm like, that looks like it's been burnt. I didn't know they were going to burn this. I came back to it and realized it was only like two ridges and real small, like the ends of two ridges. And that was it. Firehouse must have did a good job. They got it put out. But when I came back, there were two older gentlemen with firehouse stickers from a local firehouse that were up in there walking on both sides of that looking for morels.
Yeah, people will go in after burns. I mean, they can be good spots. They can be very good spots. But, I mean, you know, really, the key is learning to look up, but learn those tree species. We call them associative species, you know, trees. Some of the other stuff we look for are grapevines. If there's grapevine thickets growing up in the tree, the grapes, wild grapevines grow where there is good soil. So you're probably going to have morels there. And I'm sure Western Maryland has it, spice bush. It's a low growing bush. You break a twig off of it, it smells like lemon pledge. But spice bush will only grow in good soil. We find a lot of morels under spice bush. So, you know, I think if you just become a good woodsman, learn that, you know, your four corners are your four directions of the compass. That's another thing to learn. Learn, you know, where to point that compass and say, this is a northeast aspect. This is probably going to be a good spot to look. You know, I'm on a southwest slope. That's probably dry, probably not a good spot. But it's just being an all-around woodsman, and we sure do have fun doing it.
Yeah, it's a really cool way to get out when there's nothing else going on, to fill in the void that is no turkeys gobbling. And also, one thing that I've never done and I need to start doing, where I live, it's not that big. I don't have any friends that do it. I'm the only, like, I go out by myself and do it. I need to get some people to go with me. I got two young boys, but they can't hoof it around the mountains like I can because they're 2 and 3 and a half. But when they're older, you know, I can't wait when they're older, a couple of fresh eyes, we're going to get out there and go after it. But right now I need some buddies who I can talk into going with me.
And there you go. Christy and I mushroom hunt together, and we have our 9-year-old daughter, JC, and she's a mushroom hunter and has been her whole life. We had her in the woods when she was 2 or 3 days old, it seems like. And she's gotten pretty decent at it. But, you know, it's just another thing to get kids outside, too. And that helps them become a better woodsman, is teaching them these foraging skills. Because then they learn to pay attention in the woods. And the more they learn to pay attention, the better hunter, better outdoorsman they're going to be. I shot a picture over to you of a mushroom our daughter found in 2020. And it was the largest morel in the U.S. that year, found right here in West Virginia. And, I mean, we just make it a family affair. So as your boys get older, just get them out there.
Yeah, I'm looking at the picture now. And I look, I'm not exaggerating this. I don't know how old your daughter was in this picture, but I think that morel is larger than the size of her torso. That is ridiculous.
What was she, 5 or 6 years old? She was 5 or 6 years old in that picture. Let's see, 24 years ago. Yeah, she was 5. That morel was bigger than a milk jug, a gallon milk jug. So just to tell you how big that was. And every year since 2020 at this time, we see that picture all over Facebook. It pops up on every morel page in the country. So
I don't find many of the ones of this stature. Like I had talked about how I find a lot of grays on the one sycamore patch I have. But this, like, I love finding, I do find yellow morels. Actually, here at my house, I always find yellow morels in my sycamore patch here. My podcast studio is about 40 yards from any day now. I'm going to start seeing them pop up. It'll probably be this weekend or so. But I always find bigger ones there. I find these yellow morels. And before talking to you, I did not know that they grow less but larger. That was not a thing I understood. So now that I do, that makes sense, because when I find the yellow ones, I'm always excited because I like a morel that I can cut horizontally into rings and make into food. Like, it's great. If I found 5 pounds of morels that were 3 inches tall, I'd be happy. But the problem is I never find enough. Like, it's like when I get the big yellow ones, it's like, all right, now I got some, like, 2 meals worth. I got some eaters.
Yeah. And, that particular morel you're seeing a picture of there, that was a group of 36. And there were 2 others that were bigger than that one that had already gone bad. 36 under a dying elm tree in a pine patch. So on a disturbed hillside where there was a skid road, going a logging skid road. So there was 3 elements there that I just love to find. And that tree's still producing to this day, even though it's completely dead. We were just there the other day and there was 4 or 5 under it. But that year, 2020, there was 36 under that tree of that caliber, with that being the biggest.
Well, I want to ask you real quick then. You just spoke on 2020. 2020 yep. is brought up a lot by other people in other Facebook groups about being the big year. What made 2020 the big year? And with the warm up and with these warmer winters that we're having and these almost earlier springs, it feels like we're having, as somebody who's a big duck hunter, weather plays a big role for us. And with the warmer winters, it has correlated to a different style of hunting. Do you believe that maybe now we're going to get more of those 2020s?
I don't know. I mean, this year's kind of lining up to be that way, but if the moisture and the warm weather goes away, I mean, either one of those factors, it'll be over quick. 2020 was just spectacular. You had a February that for most of the East Coast was in the 70s, day in, day out with warm rain, and it just caused such a flush of all species of mushrooms. And then I think the second reason for 2020 being such a spectacular mushroom hunting spring is everybody was on lockdown in the United States. Everybody. Don't go to work. Don't do anything. So anybody that lives in the country, what we did is we hit the woods. We were in the woods every day from daylight to dark. Why sit at the house and be bored and look at each other? So we found time, but we ran into a lot of people that found mushrooms that year that normally didn't mushroom hunt because they were laid off. They, you know, their job was shut down. So I think this year has that chance to have that kind of a flush, but are we going to have that many people out there hunting them to report back, hey, this is an awesome flush? So I don't know if that makes sense, but with the weather, I do agree with you, because I, even though I'm over here in the mountains, kind of up high and out of the flyway, I'm a duck hunter. I love to duck hunt. But we are so weather dependent on here. If Lake Erie doesn't freeze and Northern Ohio doesn't get 2 feet of snow, we get zero ducks. Okay.
Yep.
And that's what's happened the last 3 years. We've had zero ducks. I mean, we didn't get into the ducks this year the last 2 days of the season. Okay. So I think that weather does correlate. You know, are we warming up some on this earth? Yeah, we are. Is it going to move our mushroom season earlier? Yeah. But what I've also seen, you know, the last couple years, it's gotten dry during what should be peak time. And last year we found, you know, 5 pounds altogether the whole year. And we're normally finding 50 to 60 pounds. So, you know, if it's warm and wet, yeah, you're going to have mushrooms from nowadays from the end of February all the way through May. But if either one of those goes away, that factor, that warm or that wet, you're just going to be out of luck. They're such a fragile organism.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I get that 100%. I got one more question for you here. It's about something you talked about earlier. Before we get off morels, I want to touch on some other things. But one thing you said was disturbed areas. And does that mean disturbed within 6 months, 6 years? How long? Like, what does that mean?
That's a good question. I mean, I have seen morels, but okay. For example, a patch of timber behind our house, we just had it cut this winter. So we're going to get in there and hunt heavy for morels this spring and just see if the fresh disturbance has caused any bloom of morels. Sometimes a fresh disturbance will cause a bloom. That gas pipeline where I referred to that's up on our YouTube channel this evening, it had been grassy, kind of overgrown, and they mowed it 2 years ago, and they mowed it with one of those rotary mowers that really kind of chews up the top layer of topsoil also. And that just caused that area to bloom the last 2 years. So that's fresh disturbance. But our best patches are on disturbance that's 6 to 15 years old on a old slip, below, you know, a hillside road or below a gas well, you know, logging roads, that they build that they push the refuse over the hill. The soil refuse over the hill, it becomes, disturbed soil with, associative species on it. And you'll find those morels there. So that was a good question. I think it's a little bit of both, you know, freshly disturbed or that, you know, 6 to 15 year later deal.
Yeah, because I know of a current, I'm not going to say where it's at because I don't want people going there, but there's a patch, there is a clear cut in the state of Maryland that I know of, and it's not very big, but they left a couple mother poplar trees, and those poplar trees, I guarantee you 90% of what is in this clear cut is young growth poplar, and then a bunch like around it, like when I say a bunch, I mean like some 36 inch poplar trees. And there's probably like 12 to 18 of them around the outside, and a couple they left in the middle. So this area is primed up. Actually, last year I swore I found the bases. I did, not swear. I found the bases of mushrooms. Somebody had gotten there before that I got in there and found them. So I'll be headed there tomorrow morning, actually. But
there you go.
So it's, but these areas, like that clear cut has been in there a little while. And I wonder, it's right. Like, how long, you know, should you wait or whatever? But like you said, right after burns, right after big clear cuts, people swear that's the best time to go. But then also 5 years later, look at this patch here that I was just talking about. It's the most primed up I've ever seen an area for a morel mushroom. So,
right. And it kind of some of the same areas I was describing to you earlier, you know, the big poplar, like, you know, big old daddy poplar tree, you know, he was growing in a field at one time because our whole area here was clear cut with little farms back at the turn of the 19th century. Now it's all woodland again. And so you got, you know, 18 to 20 inch poplar trees, and then you find those two or three big ones that were in the field that's their daddies, that are now towering over these smaller ones, but that's where you find your morel. So very, very good places to look.
So I want to touch on some other foraging aspects before we hop off of mushrooms or we'll hop out of morels, hop into another mushroom sectors. My favorite mushrooms to eat are oysters and lion's manes. Now, that's not that I don't like morels. I actually like all mushrooms. I haven't tried wood ears yet because I'm a little weird about the texture, but I have a bunch behind my house, and I just found a big flush 2 days ago with my son. I think I'm going to cut them off and try them. But my favorites are oysters and lion's manes, and I know everybody has their own favorites. Do you have, is morel your favorite, or do you have something else you really like to look for?
Well, morels are my favorite, but we look for all of them. I mean, oysters are really good. We also enjoy looking for chanterelle around the 1st of July is when we get flushes of those. And, you know, they're good to eat. Then we get into August and September, and we really start looking for chicken of the woods and hen of the woods. And those are some other really good edibles that we enjoy finding. I'm by no means a all-around mushroom expert, but I do know, you know, the ones that are good to eat. Lion's mane, I haven't got to eat a lot of that, but I have found them, and I have handed them off. And a lot of my buddies like to make them into crab cakes.
Yeah,
I don't know if you've ever tried them that way, but... I've heard that. I got to try that. But my favorite by far is morels. We got a big dish of them soaking at the house for tomorrow evening. And I'm sure we'll do some kind of video showing how to put them together for dinner. So
that's cool. Yeah. I like that you guys kind of show people that aspect of it too.
Yeah. We're trying to show a little bit of everything on that. So, finding them, fixing them, and, maybe even eating them. So,
right on.
Yeah, we have fun doing it. We have fun doing it. So,
do you guys look for anything else when you're out foraging? I know some people like they might grab some wild garlic when they're out, or they might grab like around here. Ramps are not as dense as they are maybe out in West Virginia or Western Maryland. So people around here get pumped when they find a good flush of ramps.
We do dig a lot of ramps every year. I mean, we try to forage as much as possible. You know, I don't think there's anything better than morels, ramps, and some fresh deep fried turkey nuggets from a mountain gobbler. So that's some ultimate foraging there.
Yeah, absolutely. I love some fried wild turkey breasts. When I tell people who I'm friends with who don't turkey hunt, when they think of turkey, they think of domestic turkey. And I tell them, I don't eat domestic turkey. but I love wild turkey, if that tells you anything. I don't even like domestic turkey. I'll eat the deli meat on a sandwich, but I don't even like domestic turkey.
I'm an equal opportunity turkey eater, but I do like the wild ones. They are my favorite. Little JC's always, hey, are we having deep fried turkey nuggets tonight? And I tell her, well, that just depends on how straight you're going to shoot this morning. So, yes, sir. We're great time of the year to be in. Ramps, morels, and turkeys over here, trout. I'm sure over your way, a lot of fish species are starting to move in on and shallower water, easier to fish for. And just a great time of the year.
Yeah, definitely my favorite. And I think that it, all the information you gave us today on morels and woodsmanship is a big deal, because if someone can go from being just a turkey hunter to being an avid, if not forager, at least an avid morel hunter and be a turkey hunter, it makes it like that much better. It makes it twice as nice when it's springtime.
Yeah.
This is my favorite time of the year before I knew how to look for morels. Now that I do, it's like I could spend, like you said, you can spend all day out there. And I don't do it with anybody else, but I'd imagine if you get a group of people together and you're all hanging out all day long looking for morels and glassing here, glassing there, filling the backpack or filling, you know, your net, whatever, I'd imagine it's very fun to do it that way.
Yeah, it's fun to go out in a group and just watching other people have fun. I like finding them. I love saying, oh, I got five over here. Sometimes I get yelled back. Yeah, well, keep them to yourself. I'm looking over here, you know. So, but it's fun. Fun to compare numbers. You get the brothers and sisters out there competing against each other and let them come in at the end of the day and say, oh, I found this many, and give a little bit of razzing to each other. You know, I think morels are one of the world's best participation trophies. Get out there, find them, and enjoy them. It's a short season.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Hey, now that we've gone through morels and we've gone through some foraging stuff and learned some people up, why don't you tell everybody about your other business, about your business rather, about Longspur and what you guys do. You guys are local to us. I mean, you guys could be helping people out that we have listening to this podcast.
Oh yeah. I appreciate greatly giving us some time to tell you who we are. Longspur Tracking and Outfitting. We're based right here in Buckhannon, West Virginia. We have 55 trackers in 10 states. And when I say trackers, these are guys with well-trained and gals with well-trained dogs that find wounded game for people. I do have, a handful of trackers in Maryland. I've got a really good tracker over on the Eastern Shore by the name of Benjamin Wheeling. Mike Effords in Carroll County, great guy, has a couple of good bloodhounds. And then I've got some West Virginia boys that live in the panhandle that cover Western Maryland for me, and some of Pennsylvania. So we do cover the areas where your listeners are at. So we get out there and we track wounded deer, whitetails, pika over on the Eastern Shore. One of my trackers, really good bear tracker in Western Maryland. We have fun doing that. We've been blessed and have grown exponentially, to the point that, you know, we're doing our own productions. We'll be showing tracks on video and telling the stories of these hunts, which is something we've done on our social media, for the last 5 years. We write the stories of each hunt. I tell people it was almost like a Field and Stream or an Outdoor Life story about each of these hunts and recoveries, and just tell the story how it happened. Now we're going to start laying these down on video. One of the other things we do, and we just started, is in legal states, and Maryland is one of them, we'll be offering some limited thermal drone recovery that'll come out with the dog. So we have the option of offering the dog or thermal drone, depending on how the properties lie or if the hunter can get permission to put a dog on it. And if he can't, maybe we can fly a drone over it. So we'll be doing that in Maryland this fall, covering as much area as we can. But like I said, we're 55 trackers in 10 states, just out there busting, working hard to help as many hunters out as we can a year. We had 3,500 phone calls last year, over basically Ohio, West Virginia, Kentucky, Maryland, and Pennsylvania. 3,500 phone calls for help. Out of those 3,500, of course, we interview, decide the tracks we should take. Our trackers recovered 308 whitetail deer last year. So those are tags punched, conservation at its finest, bunch of meat saved. Unfortunately, sometimes the coyotes beat us to the deer, but we enjoy our job and we get out there and bust it. And if you want to follow along, Long Spur Tracking and Outfitting on Facebook, and this is where you can find links also to our mushroom programming on YouTube, and just a bunch of good information on there. We're constantly posting about morels this time of year. So Long Spur Tracking and Outfitting on Facebook.
I appreciate you taking the time, Sean. It was I learned a bunch. I know the listeners learned a bunch, and I'm actually excited, because now I'm going to go out with this brand new knowledge tomorrow morning.
Oh, there you go.
Before I got to go do some work, because I do have to do a lot of that. But I'm going to go out and look for some morels now. And I appreciate the time you took. If you guys ever need a shout out, you ever need help, whatever, you let me know. I'm right over here in Gettysburg.
Well, we appreciate that. I might hunt you down during duck season.
You just let me know. I'm all over the place. I hold a Virginia, Pennsylvania, and Maryland license every year. I can hunt anything, anywhere in those three states. If I buy any more licenses, my wife will kill me. So,
well, one good thing is, and keep this in mind, you don't have to have a hunting license to hunt morels.
That's absolutely true. Long as you're on public land or have permission, it's all good.
That's right. So if you ever want to come on over.
Absolutely. Hey, you have a good night, man. It was great talking to you. Thank you for taking the time.
Thank you, Mike. I appreciate you having me on your podcast.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
Yo, what's up, everybody? It's Mike. Hey, I want to let you guys know real quick. My wife and I own JC Estate Prep Services as well as Junk Clear. What we do is full scale, top to bottom. Everything from cleanouts and deep cleaning and landscaping and renovations, repairs, mold remediation, tree work, like demo. We'll do anything in the home to get the home prepped for real estate. We also do the same stuff outside of a real estate situation if you need it. We do moving, we do storing, estate situations. Grandma or grandpa just passed and you guys need someone to take care of all the headaches that go along with it. How about an estate sale? I got a connection. We'll help you guys through the entire thing. Storage, everything. So rental resets, real estate preparation, and estate situations, estate sales. You need to get everything done. Look, everybody leads their own lives. How about this? How about instead of cramming all this stuff in, you let us take care of it for you? And oh yeah, we'll get paid. We accept payment on the back end at closing. We do like to get paid up front like anybody else, but we will accept payment at closing. We can put anything in a contract, guys. We do everything. We have vendor lists, subs, the whole thing. So reach out, let us know. If you guys know any realtors, hey, do your buddy Mike here a solid. Reach out. Tell them about us. Tell them about what we do. What we're doing is really cool. It's been kick-ass. I'm not even going to lie. Like, the people that we work with are mind blown at how fast we can get this stuff done and how quickly they can then get the house sold and how much more money they can then make. It's pretty tits. And everybody wins. Okay. Everybody wins in the situation. You get more money. Realtor gets more money. We get paid. Everybody's happy. I get to feed my kids. You get to sell a home and make $100,000+, $300,000, whatever. You get to make all that money. Okay, quickly and efficiently. Reach out to your realtor friends. Let them know about us. I appreciate you. Thanks.